Welcome to the Make or Miss podcast. I'm Seth Cartmell. I'm joined today by a very special guest, Professor Iago Colas from University of Michigan, a comparative literature professor, and you teach courses on kind of sports culture. Do I have that right?
You have that right, yes. Thanks. It's good to be here.
Thanks. I wanted to talk to you today because you've been writing a lot of really interesting stuff recently about kind of the I want to say the culture of how we discuss the NBA, and it really first came to my attention in kind of post the NBA finals when there was sort of a brouhaha about the interaction between LeBron James and David Blatt, and specifically in response to a column that Mark Stein wrote about it. But I think it's been a kind of a broader thing of kind of how of the interaction between those two specifically, and how a player is supposed to relate to a coach specifically. And I just kind of, if you could kind of summarize your thoughts on that and we'll go from there.
Sure. So I guess the impetus for the piece that I wrote was a column that Mark Stein wrote on ESPN. That was, I guess, more of an editorial than really a reporting column, although he did mention some things that he'd seen while covering the finals. And, the feeling that I got from his piece was that he felt that LeBron James was behaving in a way that was disrespectful towards the coach, and maybe he didn't use these terms, but maybe he would have said passive-aggressive or something like that, that he was calling his own plays from time to time or shouting over Coach Blatt during timeouts, things like that that he claimed to have seen. And my feeling wasn't so much that, and this is a general point about my work, I would say that I'm not necessarily weighing in on the specifics of how that relationship ought to be functioning, certainly not on Blatt's qualifications as an NBA coach, but I focus a lot on the language that people use to talk about, as you said, the NBA and the culture of the NBA. And there I felt that Stein was, I'm sure, unintentionally, I would say mobilizing or deploying a kind of language that has a long history in the NBA and that involves several assumptions, foremost among them that players should be subordinate to their coaches in a kind of hierarchical arrangement of authority where decision-making is concerned on a team. And in addition, I tried to point out that because of the racial dynamics of the NBA, where for most of its history, well, really for all of its history, coaches have been mostly white, and for most of its history, players have been mostly black, that in a sense, there are some unsavory kinds of intersections, let's say, between that kind of language and racial dynamics in American society at large. So without then trying to be very careful not to say that Mark Stein is racist or was motivated by racist views in what he said, I was trying to point out some of the racist or racializing implications of the argument he was making.
Sure. And I kind of, you mentioned kind of the hierarchical nature, and that in itself, it doesn't really square with the reality of anything we really know about the NBA in, over the last, I would say, 30 years or more. In terms of kind of the actual power dynamics between the players and coaches. I mean, it's a players' league is kind of a pretty common thing to discuss about the league now, is it not?
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think that is much more, at least, let's say it's, I mean, I guess I would say it's an owners' league, but where players and coaches are concerned, it's certainly a players' league. And yet it seems to me that at least in some quarters of NBA discussion, our way of thinking about what should be hasn't really caught up to what is.
How much of that do you think is maybe analogizing, you know, kind of one's own experience? And I mean, having talked with you briefly a little bit before, I know we both kind of played basketball to some level, but nothing close to the NBA level, but kind of the difference between, you know, your sort of your high school JV coach and his kind of martinet kind of ways and what's really a more, you know, almost a partnership between two adult professionals, which is what we have in the NBA, and it's a very different relationship, I would think.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think that you probably observe the kind of on-court actualities of the NBA more closely than I do, and maybe you can speak to this. My sense is that maybe in some cases there's a partnership. In other cases, the fact that there's a kind of relative equality of power, or that the players, at least the star players, have more power within an organization than a coach, doesn't necessarily, in my mind, always lead to it being a partnership. It can lead to conflict as well, where one party isn't able to kind of assert authority over the other. But I do think that really going back to the time when basketball was invented and the circumstances under which it was invented, which was essentially to try to entertain and divert and in that way tame a group of students that was viewed as incorrigible, there has been a long kind of standing trend in the way that we think about basketball and basketball teams that views players as in need of, first of all, instruction, which of course in some cases is certainly the truth, but also a kind of moral control, where they should be mentored in matters of character and moral qualities like unselfishness, discipline, effort, and so forth. And that really, I think, my guess is it still flourishes very much at that kind of broad base of the youth culture of basketball and through college basketball for that matter. And while the situation's in fact very different in the NBA, I think that for many fans and maybe some observers in the media, they are still looking at the NBA through that kind of lens that has that long history and that still is operative at the base, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely, and you know, there's probably a lot that's you know, appropriate kind of in terms of using sports as kind of a teaching tool for those kind of things. But you know, for people who have, you know, reached the level of you know play of being able to get to the NBA, strikes me that lessons about hard work are probably not as necessary as they might be, since that's kind of a necessary condition to getting there in the first place, I would say.
Exactly. That's right.
And I don't know if you agree with it, but that's sort of one of my a pet peeve about a lot of kind of discourse around the NBA is, you know, sometimes there's a if only this player would work harder, he would be better at.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah, that's a pet peeve of mine as well. I mean, and it falls under the category of a larger set of pet peeves I have that generally involves really failing to appreciate what these athletes are capable of, intellectually, morally, and physically, and the level of focus and dedication and work that's been required to get them to the level that they're at. And, you know, we see this in the way that, as you say, certain players, even, you know, top-notch players, are criticized, but sometimes it's even more visible in the ways in which kind of second tier, third tier reserves in the NBA are treated as though they are terrible, when in fact they may suffer occasionally from ineffectiveness in relation to their peers, but we're still talking about the best basketball players in the world, all of whom I think have exhibited, you know, those traits that I described, you know, hard work and discipline and so forth.
Sure, and it seems like it also goes the other way too. I think that, I mean, sticking a little bit with the NBA Finals, some of those qualities take on almost a life of their own in certain cases, and become in kind of the popular narrative more important than actual skill. And you know, the obvious, I'm obviously talking about Mario Dellavedova now. Who, you know, is, you know, there's nothing wrong with being, you know, a gritty, gutty backup point guard, but you're still a backup point guard,
exactly.
You know, and though these mystical qualities don't change that fact, I guess.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about Matthew Dellavedova. For one thing, I should kind of disclose that, you know, I don't live far from Cleveland, and so I was definitely rooting for the Cavs and found myself experiencing a kind of love-hate relationship with Dellavedova, there's no denying that he was at times making certain plays that were great for the team. And oftentimes those plays seem to be the result of just an exceptional level of effort. At the same time, he was making a lot of plays that drove me nuts and kind of playing well beyond his limitations. And, but most of all, I think what bothered me was the way in which he was latched onto as a kind of hero figure for many fans. And, you know, I'm saying fans from the point of view of what I read on Twitter or Facebook or other social media or even on the web. And there again, I mean, the kinds of terms you sort of paraphrased, gritty, hardworking, hustling, those terms have a history in basketball culture. And at one point in time, those terms might have been used in a kind of neutral way, but at a certain moment, as the NBA especially, but eventually all of basketball kind of integrated racially, and as African Americans came to dominate the sport, those terms started to get to be used to rescue white players who were otherwise not really finding a footing on which to be kind of mentioned in the same breath with the great black players in the NBA. So it's bothersome to see those terms get latched on to a player like Matt Dellavedova, not because he's not hardworking or anything like that. Of course he's hardworking, but because so are the players, other players on the team and on the opposing team who don't have his limitations and skin tone.
Sure. And there's almost an analogy on his own team and, you know, Iman Shumpert, we don't know exactly yet what, you know, exactly his injury was, but I think it's fairly clear at this point that he was, you know, playing through an immense amount of pain to just, you know, be out on the court. And, you know, we haven't really heard anything we've heard about it, but just it's the, and maybe it's because, you know, he's a former first round pick who's been, you know, a decent player in the league for a couple of years and not an undrafted second year guy out of nowhere. But there's other differences too, and that seems inescapable.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, I think that's a great example. I mean, for my money, I'm perhaps, again, you know, those people who really observe the X's and O's more closely and with more expertise than I would differ. But for my money, Shumpert was the best perimeter defender on that team. And one who was working hard guarding a number of different players throughout the series and who made some really important plays defensively. He was playing through pain. That was evident. I agree. And if it's overlooked to some degree, it might be for the reasons you said. It might be also because he's perceived to have a kind of natural, quote unquote, natural athletic ability that facilitates his defensive prowess in a way that Dellavedova is presumed not to have that athletic ability and may not have it. But in either case, I would argue it's not a natural athletic ability, but one that Shumpert has developed over the course of his lifetime through many, many hours of training.
There's a germ of natural gift there, obviously. I mean, I think that both of us would have loved to have been, you know, 6'5 with long arms and so on and so forth. But there's a lot of people who are 6'5 with long arms and good coordination who don't reach that level. So obviously there's been, you know, work and intentionality to getting to that point. And like you said, that's hard work that deserves to be respected and lauded as well.
Yeah. Not to belabor the point, but you know, nobody is born 6'5" with long arms, fast, with great leaping ability, and the intelligence to play basketball. And that every one of those things develops over time. Some of it develops, of course, as a result of genetics, like height. But you know, I couldn't quantify it, but I would say a very high percentage of what we see displayed in NBA games is the result of work.
Yeah, I would agree. And actually, this is sort of the discussion of kind of the language used to describe people. I think we just had we're recording this on the Friday after the draft, and it seems like it's mostly gotten a little better in recent times. But the kind of the coding language that you were alluding to was extremely prevalent as recently as I would even 3 or 4 years ago, in terms of talking about, you know, you wouldn't need a picture to know the ethnicity of a player if one is described as having, you know, a high hoops IQ and another has a great natural feel for the game. I mean, those are just,
yeah,
that's you know, that was inescapable. And
yes,
it seems like the analysts have gotten better about that, but
it seems like they have, I guess. I think that you're reminding me that maybe a year or two ago, some website, maybe it was Deadspin, I don't know, had kind of combed through some NFL scouting reports. I don't know if you remember seeing this. And they had found the sort of correlated the number of times certain adjectives were used to the race of the players. And there was a somewhat predictable pattern where intelligence, maturity, et cetera, were kind of coded and attached much more frequently to white players, whereas speed, athletic ability, natural talent were much more often attributed to black players. So I think that's the kind of thing you're talking about, and I think it has been more prevalent in the NBA in the past. I think it has improved, no doubt. But I think the attitudes are still out there, and it's important not to kind of relax about them, honestly.
Yeah, and it's still there. I mean, it's much more in the kind of the player comparisons, which is a whole other, you know, rant to go off on, and how they obscure more than they illuminate. But I mean, if you're you know, you're talking about, you know, Frank Kaminsky, the names that he's being compared to are, you know, are Kelly Olynyk and
right.
It's like, okay, those are two guys you picked out, and Troy Murphy, and
yes, right.
So, anyway, maybe moving to a slightly different topic, although
sure.
I guess related to the draft a little bit, since the Knicks were kind of in the controversial in selecting a sort of an unknown Latvian kid. Another thing that you've
right.
been talking a lot about recently is it's sort of related, is kind of the conservatism of Phil Jackson, and I kind of wanted to
oh,
get
yeah.
into that a little bit. I guess just kind of let you talk about that for a second, and the dreaded talk about question, but
that's okay. No problem. So, I mean, if I may, you know, I think I would make a kind of general point, first of all, that's not exclusive to Phil Jackson, but in a way it touches on or continues something I was saying just kind of right before we started, about sort of our narrative impulses as human beings. And I think part of what happens is that when we have intense feelings about a subject, we tend to find ways to tell stories that make those feelings seem rational and legitimate and justified, as opposed to what they are, which is just feelings. So to some degree, I think that what I read, and we're talking about interviews and profiles of Phil Jackson that took place over the last couple of weeks, in which among other things, he was complaining about much of the play in today's NBA, too much isolation ball. He's talking about the superiority of the triangle and a style of basketball in which the ball is moving, bodies are moving, everybody's involved, players are interchangeable, and comparing it to the teams that he played for on the Knicks in the early 70s, which in the mythology of those teams were seen to be supremely unselfish and playing a kind of perfect, idealized type of basketball. And I sort of began with the preface I began because at one level, I think part of what's happened to Phil Jackson is something like nostalgia and loss. He's an older guy who's remembering a period of time very fondly, remembering his own successes as a coach in the early 90s and early 2000s with the Bulls and then the Lakers. And having a hard time adjusting to reality and letting go of those kind of feelings of loss and moving on. But more specifically, I think in terms of basketball culture, what I would say is that Phil has done something that maybe a lot of especially men of his generation, have done, which is take something that worked under very specific conditions in terms of player personnel, rules in the game, et cetera, and idealized it and turned it into a kind of normative template for what should always happen under all conditions, regardless of personnel, regardless of rules, regardless of game conditions even. And that is the conservatism I'm talking about. There is there for me a kind of attachment to a specific kind of thing and an unwillingness to accept changes and to adapt to those changes. And that's what I was hearing in Phil Jackson over the course of the week.
And the way I like to describe it is he's, you know, it's an aesthetic judgment on his part, which is, you know, it's totally legitimate
right.
to say, I would prefer basketball to look
like. Of course.
That's but saying, then transforming to that, not only is that, you know, correct for the game conditions today, which I think is demonstrably false, but also, but also, like, that's, there's some, like you were talking about earlier a little bit, is almost a moral rectitude to,
yes,
to
right.
that thing. And that's almost, I mean, what, you know, just being wrong is fine, but the other part is more troublesome, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, Phil, I agree with you saying this is the kind of what he is feeling, but not saying, is this is, to me, the most beautiful basketball. And what he's saying is this is tactically and morally the best basketball, objectively speaking. And that gap between what he's feeling personally, idiosyncratically, subjectively, and what he's saying and dictating as a norm, that gap's really problematic.
And that's why
it gets back to that just sense I have that most of our narratives, however they may be dressed up, are ultimately very personal, and they're rooted in idiosyncratic experiences of the world. And I think we'd be a lot clearer in communicating with one another if we were able to be more upfront about those preferences as such.
So, you know, putting yourself in, making a comparison, this is kind of an Obi-Wan and the Emperor almost opposite between the two, Greg Popovich is a coach who's been upfront about not really liking a lot of the kind of the newfangled stuff, but at the same time he's like, I also like winning, so. And this is what my players can do, so let's do that.
Exactly. Yep. I think that's an excellent comparison. Yeah, contrast rather. Yes.
And so, if you're, is that kind of the more what you're talking about in terms of kind of separating what I like from what I need to do for professional reasons in this case? Would that be the
yeah. I think so. And I would add, I mean, I think that a kind of another mark in sort of the contrast is that Popovich isn't just sort of grudgingly adapting. He's adapting at the very least with a great deal of respect for his players. So when he kind of started changing the system in San Antonio to reflect his personnel and what they were capable of and able to do, it seemed clear to me that however much he may have prefer a certain style of play, he's also admiring of what his players can do that, you know, that he had to adapt to. So there's something really admirable in that, I think.
And I think that, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think it probably has something to do with their success. That is that I imagine the players, you know, are part of why they do what they do on that team is because they know that they are all respected for what they can do.
And he's usually the first person to say, well, I didn't do that. You know, luckily enough, he's in a situation where I didn't do that giving some praise to his players as opposed to, I didn't do that. Like, these guys screwed it up, not me.
Right.
which is a whole other thing. And that kind of, I think that gets back a little bit to what I was, getting at the terms of talking about a partnership earlier. I mean, you're obviously right. It was big news, current with Sacramento Kings and George Karl and DeMarcus Cousins that that's obviously not a partnership, or at least not a
exactly.
functional one. But that's the kind of the aspirational goal, seems like, you know, this is what a, not just a basketball team, but what a functional workplace looks like.
Yes,
and
that's well put.
And it you know, the kind of the strict, almost militaristic hierarchy that seems to want to be imposed, it doesn't seem like it necessarily, perhaps with certain mixes of personalities it works, but it, as a, on a broad sense, it doesn't seem like it's conducive to that. Am I overgeneralizing?
I agree with you. No, I think that's really well put. I'm not sure I can improve upon that formulation. I agree. I think it's true not just in basketball. But, you know, there's a way in which it's especially true in basketball where, because of the dynamic, fluid nature of the game in which almost every player is involved in every play, one has to acknowledge the fact that players are driving what we are seeing on the court, regardless of what they've done in practice, regardless of what systems are in place for their team. It simply is a kind of, at worst, a kind of fantasy to imagine that these players are just sort of like video game figures being manipulated by a coach, and that that's the way it should be. I mean, that's simply not the case. And so, of course, I think any arrangement of power and decision-making and simply behavior that reflects that fact that everybody is contributing to the product on the floor differently, but in equal measure, at least in equal measure, is a better way of arranging power in that workplace.
Sure. And that sort of touches on another idea of yours, which I find somewhat appealing, which would be completely transgressive in, you know, the modern sporting culture, is, you know, do we need a coach?
Exactly.
And, on a technical level, you need someone there. I don't want it to sound, you know, pie in the sky, like, you know, it's going to be a commune and we'll figure it out. And there are some technical things that obviously someone not on the floor doing would be very helpful, just as far as division of labor goes. But in terms of the boss, do we need that person?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what I'm questioning. I mean, I think that what I'm really trying to get at there with that kind of provocative question of do we need a coach is not so much to kind of, it's not a rhetorical question into which to me the obvious answer is no or anything like that, but it is really trying to think, instead of thinking about individual people and the positions, individual positions that they hold, I'm interested in the things that get done and the functions that are carried out. So as you kind of already, I think, intimated in what you said, right, there are a number of different functions that a coach carries out. Some of those, it may be important for an individual off the floor to continue to carry out. Others, it may not be. And I think if we kind of drilled down a bit and, again, looked at the actual dynamics, the actual relationships, and the actual functions that are required for a basketball team to succeed, if nothing else, I think we'd see that individual that held the position called coach would have considerably less to do than what we currently expect that they should do or that we want them to do.
Sure. And, you know, getting back to the example we started the conversation, who is more likely to know more about, you know, both what's happening right now on the court and also what kind of works in general in the NBA between LeBron James? And this is not intended as a slight on David Blatt. It's just a matter of, you know, both experience and respect for, you know, LeBron's, you know, demonstrated genius for the game, but who's likely to have a better insight into that, you know, in kind of in the moment between the two of them. And
exactly.
And so while you could maybe on a personal level, you know, quibble with some of the stuff that was reported, you know, you're not wrong. You're just a jerk. might be the best way to phrase some of it. You can quibble with maybe the way it's expressed. I mean,
of course,
you know, LeBron should have a lot of the quote coach responsibilities. It seems to me those are almost the kind of players you hope you have, the ones who can make decisions on their own without constantly needing to look over to the bench for reassurance that I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah, well, it used to be a thing that was desirable, although it tended to be incarnated in the popular imagination in a white point guard, which was the coach on the floor, right? And it seems that basketball culture is okay with that when the coach on the floor looks and behaves a certain way, and maybe not so okay with that when the coach on the floor looks like LeBron. And yet, I think that that's an indispensable function that probably not just one player on the floor should be playing. And I think anybody who's played basketball regularly is well aware of the kind of, I'm not sure how to put this, but the signals, the information that's being...
The communication.
Kind of, yeah, and just what you're picking up. I mean, it's just today playing, I was playing pickup ball today at noon, and the kid that I was matched up against, a young kid, very talented, definitely a better player than I am, younger, more energetic, better shape. But I could tell that today he was, and I'm not sure I could tell you how I could tell, but I could tell today that he was not feeling confident in his three-point shot. And that made all the difference in the world in how I defended him. If you were just looking at a scouting report based on what this kid has done over the course of the time that we played pickup ball, you would want me to run him off the line. But I knew that today I didn't need to do that, and that enabled me to defend him against the drive and made a big difference. So those are kind of micro signals that you pick up as a player, observing the player that is defending you or that maybe what your teammate's doing, that I think is really important input in a particular game.
And we're talking more about, peer learning rather than
mm-hmm.
but a top-down. And it seems to me, especially, we're talking about the professional level, people who have almost earned the right to be trusted with that a little bit. To some degree, I think they are much more than is, commonly portrayed, even as the way you put it, it's an analogy I've used before, too. It's commonly portrayed as if there's a coach holding a PlayStation controller moving five guys around at once. When there's at least in successful teams, there's a lot of, okay, here's a basic structure. You guys go do your thing, and then we'll talk about it.
There's a great deal of very complex improvisation that's going on every second of a basketball game. Some of it is really very obvious, even to a casual viewer, like the way that someone like Kyrie Irving might finish a layup in traffic, like extremely creative, clearly is adapting second by second as he's finishing a shot. But some of it's more subtle, and it's just, moving two steps into the lane on a defensive stand. And that kind of thing, players are doing that. They're making those decisions. They're not doing it because they remember that their coach told them to do it. They're doing it because they're responding because of practice and muscle memory and everything else to the circumstances that are presenting themselves at a given moment. And I think that is too often lost in these discussions that get to be kind of schematic and abstract about coaching and the ideal relationships between coaches and players.
Well, and also kind of the bulk of kind of the writing I do about basketball is from the analytics side, those are kind of some of the kind of things that can get lost also. Like there's it's at this point very hard to design a metric for okay, this player is good at knowing when to take one extra step into the lane and when not to. I mean, that's theoretically, I suppose it's possible with current information, but it boggles my mind how would you do that on a systematic level for every player in the league to find out who is the best at making that micro decision.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because I mean I'm not the person with the aptitude to really comprehend a lot of the advanced analytics, and I'm in awe of what they are able to quantify. And yet, at the same time, at least as advanced by some people, I don't think the best people involved, but some people, they are trotted out as though they really have mapped the whole game and modeled the whole game. And I just think it's clear that that's not the case.
Anyone who says that is lying. Like, they're lying or they're selling something most likely themselves.
Right.
The kind of that degree of certitude is one of the actually has been probably, I think, one of the bigger impediments to you know, increasing the use of what is actual kind of empirical knowledge into improving
exactly.
the game. But that's me.
That's me getting on
my soapbox. So
yeah, well, that's good. Not at all. I agree with you.
Actually, you mentioned something that I hadn't thought of this before. I mean, it occurred to me before, but I wanted to get your thoughts on it. You talked about Kyrie Irving's creativity finishing around the basket. And it seems like he's a guy who, prior to this season, you as a Cavs fan probably know this more than most, has gotten a lot of kind of criticism for being a showboaty, me first player, to you know, paraphrase some of that. And I wonder how much of that is just he's, for lack of a better term, he's fancy. You know, his dribbling with the ball, his layups and stuff like that. Like they're not standard. They're fancy, and so that makes him look like he's showing off, when in actuality these are all, as we said before, largely very practiced things that are, you know, that are as effective as a more boring player might be. Or am I reading too much into that?
No, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I hadn't really thought of it myself, but certainly, you know, his ball handling abilities and his ability to score in traffic in the lane clearly are the result of practice. And I also agree that much of what people might see as kind of purely ornamental is actually very practical and more utilitarian than most people are able to see. And I think partly that reflects a kind of shift in the nature of the point guard position over the last, decade or so, as we've seen more and more point guards with the ability and the will to score and to use their scoring ability and their threat as scorers to kind of create space and opportunities for their teammates. That's another area, I think, where basketball culture has kind of been slow to catch up, in that, as you know, back in the day, the point guard's job was to get the ball across half court and then to distribute it to teammates who were presumed to have better scoring abilities and, you know, to knock down the occasional open shot. And at least that was my job back in the 80s. That was my experience. But I think it was a common one. I think that was sort of the way things were assigned.
The Avery Johnson model of point guard.
Yes, exactly. And clearly, not only have smaller players evolved more abilities, a more diverse skill set, but larger players have also done so. And so in that sense, there's a lot there that can happen that didn't used to be able to happen on the court and that we haven't really caught up with in terms of how we talk about the game. But I think there is a kind of special attachment in some quarters of basketball culture to that point guard position for many of the reasons that we've been talking about, because the point guard is seen as kind of the coach on the floor. It was often presumed that the point guard must be the most intelligent player on the floor. And so when we see a player like Kyrie exhibiting certain physical abilities that we're not accustomed to seeing in point guards, or more to the point, I think, that historically in basketball culture have been associated with playground basketball, and therefore with African Americans, people get quick to criticize. So I think that's, off the top of my head, that's some of what I would see at work in some of that criticism that you alluded to.
And it's funny because he's celebrated now, but I'm wondering, you know, I don't think either of us are old enough to remember how Pete Maravich was talked about kind of in his heyday in terms of just to compare, you know, a guy who, you know, was a white son of a coach who still, you know, was perhaps one of the most flamboyant players of all time. And now, of course, he's rightly celebrated for his showmanship, if not necessarily his effectiveness.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering how he was discussed, not having looked into it, you know, back in the day.
Maravich?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Maravich was, I think, the way that you kind of described, I mean, as extremely skilled individually, flamboyant, but many of whose skills were useless on under game conditions. That was kind of the knock, and the proof of that would be that he didn't win. You know, and that gets us into a whole other territory about how team success winds up being somehow, through some kind of logical alchemy, a measure of individual ability in basketball. That's something that I think happens often. I mean, most frequently in terms of just counting rings to determine who is the best player. but something that I think, again, at the very least, dramatically oversimplifies the game. And I think Maravich probably suffered a bit from that. I wonder if Maravich didn't suffer a bit, again, this was off the top of my head, but from, you know, he had his run in mostly in the early mid-70s, and that was a time when the sport was viewed at the professional level as too black, and a lot of fans were turning away from it. And I wonder if part of what Maravich suffered from was not kind of embodying the great white hope role more neatly. That is, he was playing a style of basketball associated with the ABA, with the playground, and so with black basketball players. And I think that, you know, that mainstream basketball culture, which is primarily white, maybe was looking for something else at that point, maybe looking for a second coming of Bill Bradley at that point. And instead they got Pete Maravich, and that's, you know, not going to cut it for the needs of that particular segment of the fan base.
That definitely makes sense. Actually, you said something very interesting there that I wanted to, you know, the team wins as individual ability. And I think on some level that's defensible to a degree in basketball, that it isn't in other sports, just because of, I mean, again, we've just seen with LeBron how much of an effect, obviously that's an extremely special case of how much of an effect one guy can have on a team's success. But the more interesting thing is how kind of team success is a reflection of individual moral character of the stars, or is treated as such.
Yeah, that's definitely right. The will to win. Yeah.
The will to win, the personality type, yes. You know, I don't know. That's, we've been talking a lot about, you know, race in this conversation, but that seems less racialized now and more just completely a narrative construct with very little tether in reality, it seems like.
Yeah.
Again, we're talking about pet peeves. I'm going to guess that that's kind of near the top of both of ours.
Absolutely. Sure. I would totally agree with you. And I think you're right that, in fact, LeBron's performance in the finals is a kind of interesting, I mean, you mentioned it as a kind of example, but it's also a kind of counterexample, because after all, he didn't win. And I haven't heard anybody saying this, but no doubt in time somebody will say, as dominant as he was, as his performance was unprecedented in many ways, he didn't win, and he probably didn't win because he lacked something morally. And by moral, I just mean character-wise. So, you know, did he lack a killer instinct?
He didn't make his teammates better enough.
That might be the case, right.
That has not been an uncommonly expressed sentiment. That he didn't do enough to, like, make sure that J.R. Smith hit jump shots, basically.
Right, which is very hard to understand how he's supposed to do that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think you're right. That kind of thing will happen. And of course, counterexamples are held up. From the past, Bill Russell's probably maybe one of the best known. Jordan is obviously the other one, where you've
or
got
the most annoying is Kobe, but that's
right, exactly, sure. And so there's, you know, these guys who, you know, played on teams, they won a lot of championships with their teams, are obviously great players. There's no question about that. But I think there's a lot of reason to kind of argue with the idea that they somehow individually lifted their supposedly subpar teammates to victory. And I will say that I do think that, though, you know, every player I just mentioned is African American, that doesn't prevent them from getting mobilized in a racialized discourse, by contrast with other African American players. So in the case of Russell, his counterpart is Chamberlain, who clearly, according to this way of telling the story, you know, lacked the moral qualities that Russell possessed, and that that lack was the reason why Chamberlain only won two titles and Russell won whatever, 11, I guess. And when you look closely at the kind of period discourse, that is what was being reported in the media at the time, you see that a lot of the qualities that Chamberlain is, that are attributed to Chamberlain, egotism, laziness, lack of intensity, selfishness, all of that, you know, those are things that historically actually have been adjectives used to describe African-American men more generally in society. So the way in which that kind of discourse carries over from society into basketball, oftentimes I think without the people who are using it recognizing where they're getting their language, why it might even occur to them to describe Wilt Chamberlain in these terms, I think is part of what I think, you know, we need to talk more about when we're thinking critically about basketball culture and about this particular issue of the relationship between individual personality traits and team successes.
Sure. So is there anything else that sort of occurs to you about kind of the, how that, you know, we started talking about myth-making a little bit, and it seems like, you know, even beyond that, like, these are laudable traits that you win, therefore you have. Even beyond that, I'm just wondering if there's anything else that really jumps out at you at the way that it's almost arbitrary that people are assigned these character traits when we, you know, personality-wise, we know very little about them aside from, you know, very carefully cultivated media images.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it depends a little bit on the moment in history that you're looking at. You know, I think that the media images, let's say back in the 60s, were much less carefully cultivated and at the same time much less kind of widespread than they are today. But I think that in general, you know, what happens when it's a little bit like Superman. I mean, we invent these people, right? In the case of Bill Russell, he's an actual person, but he is no less, in terms of what I'm talking about, a fiction than Superman. And so we attribute to him qualities that we would like to see in ourselves, that we would like to see in our society. And to the degree that those qualities are, in a sense, unrealistically great, I think that they reflect insecurities that we have as individuals or as a culture or as a subculture, as a race. It could be any number of things. I mean, in the case of Russell and Chamberlain, I have a chapter in my book on that, and it's part of what I'm noticing. What I noticed is that, you know, those two came into the league in a very dominant fashion at exactly the moment when basketball was desegregating rather rapidly at the pro level, and from there at the college level. And I really think you see in the way that people at the time talked about, there's a famous Jimmy Breslin column about Wilt Chamberlain, is Wilt Chamberlain ruining basketball? There's a fear there that something is being eclipsed, something is being lost, that a game that was played primarily a certain way by certain kinds of players who were white is being lost forever and taken over by someone else. And I think there's a good guy and a bad guy in that story in the late 50s and through the 60s. And the good guy wound up being Bill Russell. And I don't think that Bill Russell benefited from that, honestly, as far as I can tell. I think that meant that a lot of his edgier personality traits, his activist politics were kind of, you know, are left out of his story. And those are interesting parts of his story. And at the same time, the kind of full excellence of Wilt Chamberlain as a basketball player and as a teammate tend to get left out of the story. But all of that, I think, has to do with the ways in which we fantasize and turn these real human beings into fantasy figures, sort of like action figures or superheroes that help us not have to deal with our own sense of powerlessness, our own sense of fear, insecurity, et cetera.
It's funny, it's the way you're describing kind of that dichotomy and things being lost. That's, you know, that's inescapably the same thing we were talking about earlier with Phil Jackson and kind of the the authority figures of his generation. Kind of, it's history repeating itself again, just with kind of the yesterday's progressives are today's are today's fuddy-duddies almost.
Right, exactly. That's right. And I think, yeah, that's Phil is a perfect example of that. I mean, obviously, you know, the late 60s and early 70s were a very tumultuous, impactful time for those who were young at the time and lived that period.
He was literally a hippie. I mean, Phil.
Yeah, he was literally a hippie. Exactly, right. He hung out in the village and, yeah, exactly. He smoked pot and all those things. And, you know, For some people can kind of age through that and move on and adapt to the times and recognize that each generation is contributing something really valuable to the world and also has certain limitations that a previous generation maybe didn't have. Some people are just stuck, and still strikes me as, at least at this point in time, stuck. And in a way, you know, I sympathize and I understand. I think if I had been coaching Jordan's Bulls through the mid-90s and had the tremendous success I'd had, it might be very tempting to think that it had to do with me and what I was doing, that there was a formula there that was somehow the best formula of all time. And I think it would take a pretty exceptional person to be able to say, okay, that worked then for really specific reasons. What do I have in front of me now? We got to do something different.
So as kind of a last question on the topic, something that struck me last night as, you know, the boos were raining down on poor Kristaps Porzingis and you know, Jackson did a couple of other things that I kind of liked, actually, is how much of this is an act. And that's I guess, from our perspective, it's unknowable. But, like, his brand is kind of morphed into the Zen curmudgeon. And how much of what we're seeing is him kind of, because that's the role he's choosing to play, and he maybe enjoys that because it allows him to do other things. If all we're talking about is his, here's a crazy thing that Phil put on Twitter, kind of.
It's a good question. It's a really good question, and I think you really gave the best answer when you said neither of us can really know. I would say it wouldn't surprise me, though, that I mean, I'll just speak for myself. I mean, there are certain things that I may do in a kind of performative way in the world, in my classroom or what have you. But if I do them enough times, I don't know how to draw the line anymore between what's an act and what's me. And Phil's been doing that for a long time. So, you know, maybe he doesn't know either.
Or it's like, are you an undercover cop or just a drug dealer?
Right, exactly. Yes, that's it. That's a great, that's a good analogy.
Let me see. I guess one thing we talked about briefly when we were talking about before this, but we've covered it a little bit here, is and it's related to the Phil Jackson thing, is the idea that there's kind of a pure form of basketball that can be distilled from certain sort of natural law, as opposed to... This is a wholly made up construct that's been around for, you know, just over 100 years, and it naturally changes. And I don't want to say evolves, because that implies, you know,
a natural process.
Yeah, it is reengineered continuously. And and how much of our of kind of the mythmaking and understanding is based on this kind of, you know, age of legends kind of, you know, from the void came basketball kind of.
I think it is based on that. I mean, it's also based in the fact that sports and basketball in particular in this country tend to be kind of intertwined in complex and distorting ways with the spiritual life of the culture. You know, there was a movement, I don't know if you're familiar with it, in the 19th century, known as muscular Christianity, which was a kind of strain within Protestantism that was feeling that as America grew more wealthy, there was a kind of softness and effeteness appearing in Protestant men, and that it was important to kind of not lose certain frontier qualities of toughness and strength and self-discipline. And so muscular Christianity was kind of the name given to those who were preaching these particular or extolling these virtues.
You're describing Teddy Roosevelt almost, it seems like.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yes, he's a key figure in this, as was James Naismith. And so it's that linking of what you rightly described as arbitrary, let's say, human-made, artificial, engineered games with spiritual virtues, moral virtues, spiritual qualities, which are presumably natural and timeless and eternal in the way that most religious people may think of them. And when you put those two things together, it becomes, I think, tempting, I think, for certain people, let's say Phil in this case, to latch on to particular forms that the game's taken as kind of physical embodiment, like incarnations of a spirit, right? I mean, that's a Christian ideal right there, yeah? That the deity, the divine, could be incarnated, and spiritual excellence can be incarnated. And, you know, really, to me, that reverses the process. What's really going on is that you have the physical movement of bodies interplaying with minds, and what that generates is certain values or virtues that we experience as fans or as players that we value a great deal. Beauty, excellence, competition, determination, all those things, but they arise from the physical interaction of players on the court playing within these artificial constraints set up by the inventor and by subsequent reinventions of the game. There's no moment at which any basketball game is the incarnation of the spirit of basketball, because there's no such thing as the spirit of basketball.
That's dark.
Well, I think for me it's liberating.
Yeah,
liberating, because the spirit of basketball becomes a kind of normative bludgeon by which everything other than X is disparaged or criticized. And instead, what we've got is an open field to continually reinvent the sport.
Sure. Well, you kind of knocked me for a loop there.
I hope that's okay.
No, it is. I think that you know, that kind of evidences why I've really enjoyed, you know, both reading your most recent stuff and going back through, you know, some of your older stuff, because it's challenging and legitimately thought provoking. So that's
good.
So I appreciate that.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, thank you.
So, as we're wrapping up here, you mentioned your book. You're hoping to publish it in the spring, and can you describe what that's going to be?
Yeah, sure. So the book is called Ball Don't Lie: Myth, Genealogy, and Invention in the Cultures of Basketball, and it will be published by Temple University Press in early 2016. And basically what I'm doing in that book is much of what we've done in this conversation, which is kind of trace the history of the game from the time of its invention through this year, by organizing that history around 9 key myths. They're not the only myths. They may not be the most important ones, but they're the ones that I think really offer a kind of perspective on the ways in which the game has developed and also its intersections with society. And so with respect to each of those myths, each myth gets a chapter, and I begin by talking about the myth itself and how it works in kind of narrative terms. And then I explore what is it in society and in basketball at the moment that might have allowed for that myth to take hold with the kind of tenacity that it did. And then in the last part of each chapter, this is the invention part, I try to tell a different story of the players or figures or teams involved, one that is informed by historical scholarship, but is also kind of just fanciful and pleasing to me, and maybe offers an alternative. And so I try in each chapter basically to reenact what I just told you, which is to first of all say there is no idealized spirit here that we need to be worshiping. Here's why in this moment we started to believe there was. And here's what we can do with the freedom we have once we stop believing in that.
Sure. So an example of that's kind of fresh in my mind, having just read the sample, is we started off talking about kind of the coach myth, and your approach to that is to kind of through the lens of kind of Larry Brown and the cult of rightwayism, which I think that neither of us are fans of. It's fair to say. So without giving too much away, like, how would you describe kind of how the invention part of that? Is it just kind of that question we talked about earlier? Do we need a coach? Why?
Well, I mean, actually, in that particular one, I looked at Manu Ginobili in the invention part of that chapter. And the reason I did that is because in a number of the versions, let's say, of the myth of playing the right way, Ginobili and his Argentine team of the early 2000s are extolled and brought forward as idealized incarnations of the right way to play basketball, by contrast with their American counterparts. And so what I do is kind of look at Ginobili's play on the court, and I try in every one of these inventions to root them in actual observation of gameplay. And Ginobili's one of my favorite players. He's incredibly effective. And certainly, like most effective NBA players, he exhibits some of the moral qualities associated with the right way. He's an unselfish player. He's a hardworking player. That can be said of any good NBA player. What Ginobili does that is interesting to me is play a very unorthodox game. He's constantly breaking the conventional rules of basketball, and in ways that are part of his effectiveness.
Some might say the actual rules of basketball, given
also
Phil's opinion on traveling, but
yes, exactly, sure. Well, Ginobili's a good example of players who, from time to time, have sort of pushed the boundaries of the rules in ways that have changed the game. Crossover dribbling is another example of that, where initially there's a sense that something is wrong here, there's a violation, but maybe there's not. Maybe sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't is probably the more accurate thing. But in any event, what's happened is something new has entered the game, and the game has to adapt itself to that. In any event, I think that Ginobili is an excellent case because he embodies the sort of moral virtues of playing the right way without necessarily playing the right way. And yet he was brought forward as a kind of icon of the right way at that time in the sort of early 2000s, which is where that chapter is focused on.
Well, I didn't think I could be more excited to read it. And now Manu is one of my favorite players for a lot of the reasons you just described. And so I am now even more interested in seeing it when it comes out. So
that's very
kind. First of all, I want to thank you for spending time. This has been a fascinating discussion, and really kind of great to get even further insight from some of the stuff you've been writing about. And thanks a lot for taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.